This is a Dreamcast disc and is for use only on a Dreamcast unit. Playing this disc on a hi-fi or other audio equipment can cause serious damage to its speakers.
Dreamcast, up to 6 billion players.
Welcome back to the stage of history.
Why don't we play together?
Hey, it's time to make some crazy money. Are you ready? Here we go!
Please stop this disc now.
Hello and welcome to episode 10 of the Dreamcast Junkyard Dream Pod. Who would have thought we'd ever get to episode 10? I can remember, you know, starting episode 1 and thinking maybe we'd get to episode 5 and nobody would listen, but apparently people like listening.
Wait a minute, okay, episode 5 was the one that I hosted. What is this backwards stuff? Hello, Tom. Would you like to get past the introductions before you start insulting me, or do you just want to continue on with this?
That's Caleb. You might recognize his voice. And today we have an extra special guest, the newest member of the Dreamcast Junkyard team. His name is Scott, a.k.a. Doc Eggfan. He hails all the way from, you're going to hate me for this, but Down Under. Scott, welcome.
Hi. Yes. Hello. Down Under is fine. I expected some...
You expected what? Some more banter or what?
That was a wonderful introduction.
I believe he was expecting more like razzing for the fact that he's Australian. Now, I've dealt with many Australians. Actually, the forum that I'm most active on is mostly Australians. So if you're worried about me breaking into a bad Australian accent, don't worry. That's eventually going to happen, but, you know, I'll kind of ease into it.
To be honest, I was more worried about you breaking into a bad English accent.
Well, apparently my English accent is an Australian accent, so it's multi-usage, I suppose.
Excellent. Anyway... as we usually do, shall we crack on and explain to the listeners what have we been playing? Caleb, what have you been playing on the Dreamcast?
Oh, I've been playing JoJo.
Excellent.
And that stupid thing. It's so great. I mean, it's an amazing fighting game. I'm terrible at it, but man, it's so bizarre to... it actually is bizarre to try to be playing it. I got it from eBay. It shipped all the way from Japanese eBay store, and like many of the video games that I've gotten on eBay from Japan, it's an immaculate, like, mint condition. This thing literally looks like they just took the, like, I mean, normally in the US, like, you get a case, right? And it's like it's going to be all nicked, and you can kind of hold it up to the light, you can see where it's like there's just shelfware. But this thing, it's like literally it looks like it just came out of the shrink wrap. Everything's in it. Everything's immaculate. The disc looks like it's never been played before. And it's just amazing that that's somehow like every time I buy a game on eBay. And this was like super cheap. Like the US and the UK release are super expensive on this game. But the Japanese version that I got, completely playable. And it's just in amazing condition. I got it for a really, really good price.
Now, this version, is it got the white side, the white bit down the side of it on the left hand side of the case?
I don't know offhand. I'd have to take another look at it.
Because
I believe
that's
it
one,
does.
One part of the Japanese game cases that kind of goes yellow. If it's really like white and pristine, then you've got a good deal there. Yeah. Sorry, Scott, you were going
to
say?
Well, I'll just join on to that. That some of them have the white in tray, and some of them have a clear in tray with more artwork on the inlay.
Yeah.
So you get a mixture of the two. And typically, what I've done with my collection is I just buy like packets of white jewel cases to replace the yellowed ones and replace the scuffed up. Outer cases as well, but yeah, I agree with Caleb that the Japanese ones tend to take very good care of them, and they don't even seem that scuffed up when they arrive. And I was going to ask Caleb whether when you unwrapped it from the packaging, was it in one of those little plastic bags with the slip-on thing?
I have seen that before, where there's like they ship them in this little kind of sleeve where it just kind of sticks shut. And this one didn't have that, but yet still, it was like an immaculate condition. It was amazing.
The other thing I get is wrapped in Glad wrap. Was it wrapped in Glad wrap?
No, it just had kind of like a. It was in a bubble mailer, and it had like a little bit of like light paper wrap around it. but no plastic wrap.
Yeah, cling wrap or something, whatever you guys call it. I'm probably using an Australian.
One thing that I need to ask you, Scott, we will go into this very shortly. Were the boxes in Australia the same as the ones in the UK with the blue?
Yeah, identical, yeah.
Yeah, so you had the thing with all the missing corners on the boxes where you used to just break off?
Yeah. I also, back in the day, like probably 8-10 years ago, I bought unused, brand new blue cases to replace some of my broken ones. But yeah, there are a number of little broken ones with the tiny little thin hinges on the top.
Cool. We won't go into that too soon just yet. We want to save that for in a minute when we interrogate you about the Australian Dreamcast
scene.
So we'll keep that for now. However, Caleb, anything else you've been playing apart from JoJo's?
I've just been messing around with a lot of different fighters, but mainly just JoJo, and I've still been messing around with my other acquisition, which was Guilty Gear X. Both amazing games.
Yeah, brilliant, fantastic. Before we go on to you, Scott, I'll just fill people in that what I've been doing. I recently got the Dreamcast karaoke unit. I'm sad to announce that I can't actually do anything with it other than look at a screen full of Japanese writing, because it doesn't do anything unless you connect to the internet, and you can't connect to the internet with it.
That's a shame.
That's a real shame.
Yeah, it looks amazing, sat underneath one of my Dreamcasts. And the software that comes with it does run, but it doesn't do anything other than display the title screen with a nice little bit of MIDI music in the background. And yeah, there's a book that comes with it that has, listings of Bon Jovi, etc. I'd love to be able to play Bon Jovi through my Dreamcast, but I can't anymore. So,
I was going to say, it's just, I was going to razz you about it because, why have a piece of hardware? But it's I have the Game Boy Advance adapter for my GameCube, and that just sits there. I never use it, but it looks cool. So I guess, having it is like a display piece is still interesting.
Exactly. It looks amazing.
I'm guilty of owning a karaoke unit as well, but I didn't get one complete in box with the microphone or disc or anything. I managed to find a broken loose one for cheap.
What was it, like in a shop or on eBay?
No, it would have been on eBay. It was a while back now, and my plan was to remove the guts and put in a DVD player underneath, but I never got around to it.
That would have been cool.
Yeah.
Well, apart from the DVD player, the karaoke unit, I got Super Speed Racing, which is a fantastic. Well, I find to be a fantastic IndyCar star racer. I think it was released as Kart Flag to Flag in the US. I also got one called Frame Grind, which is a mech beat 'em up.
Oh, I was trying to play that one. Frame Grid. Are you talking about Frame Ride or Frame Grid?
It's a bit of a hybrid of the two. Frame Grid. It's a bit like Virtual On.
Yeah, I think that's the one I'm thinking of.
Yeah, it's the one from Software that they did Bloodborne recently and Dark Souls. And you can kind of tell you can see from the game itself that there is a bit of a throwback to the gothic kind of feel of the games that have come out recently. Do you know what I mean? Like the music and stuff. It feels a little bit like Vengeance of the Blood Angels.
What, Warhammer? The Warhammer Space Hulk?
Yeah. There's kind of orchestral music with biomechanical things on the screen. I got a massive Space Hulk vibe from it. Anyway, so there's that. The Last Blade 2, which is an SNK fighter, little known on these shows, but Rob introduced me to it on the Neo Geo last week or the week before, which, it's quite a cool game. And Street Fighter 3 Third Strike, and also, I think that was it, to be honest, Darkseid on the Sega Saturn. We're not really talking about Sega Saturns, are we? So
yeah, you say that's it, but they're quite good games, the ones you're listing there. Last Blade was weapons based, wasn't it?
It was a
2D Soul Calibur, but I think the mechanics are sort of different as well.
Yeah, very gory as well, and also the way you can kind of slice your enemy in two. The final move of your round, you kind of slice people in two from the shoulder down to the hip, and they will slide off the top of the body will slide down and disappear. It's quite gory.
Nice.
Anyway, Scott, we should get to you because you are the newest member of the Junkyard team, and you've written some pretty popular pieces on the main site.
Thanks.
Yeah, I mean, you're obviously a man who knows a little bit about the Dreamcast and a lot about, you know, Naomi and Lindbergh technology. So we should maybe move on to you and, you know, talk a little bit about where you've come from and how you came to the junkyard and all that kind of thing. So please tell everyone who's listening who you are, what you've done, and, you know, why you came to the junkyard.
Maybe I'll just start with what I've been doing recently. And this will probably get me kicked out of the junkyard because I haven't played a Dreamcast in probably over 5 years now. I've got a good excuse. So hopefully it'll mean I can stay on because when I moved from the coast. I moved from the coast of Australia inland to Canberra to live with my sister, and she lives in a small two-bedroom apartment, and I had to pack up all my gear and sort of it's all packed up in archive boxes and stored away in pantries and underneath kitchen sinks, and I've been itching to pull it back out and play it, but it's just been kept in storage for a long time, and yeah. You know, it was sort of a temporary move, but I haven't moved on since then. So
a temporary move that became permanent.
Yeah, that's right.
I know what that is like. Now, two things. Number one, the worst thing is like when I did have my old stint there, when I was living with the family, like they made me keep all my video game stuff in the unheated garage.
Oh no!
And I'm like, this is electronics. You can't do this. The Sega Genesis survived, but I think my Super Nintendo that I had, that was the reason that got destroyed, I believe, just because it was too much humidity and not enough, like, you know. It's a bad place to store electronics.
It's weird. We're all on different continents. I mean, Caleb, you're in like US. I'm in UK. Scott is in Australia. But we've all got similar stories of things being destroyed in garages or in, like, you know, temporary.
Oh, yeah, it's a shame.
Yeah, I haven't had a chance to start picking through it. I'm hoping they're all still.
Yeah, and that's the other thing too. Like, because when you started your story, I thought, oh God, this is going to be another situation where somebody had their Dreamcast stolen. And I swear to God, so many Dreamcasts have been stolen.
Really,
it's got to be the most stolen console in the U.S.
Because
everybody that I've talked to had like a story. My personally, the first console that I've ever owned was a Dreamcast, and it was stolen right from out under the TV.
Wow.
And I never found it.
Oh.
And a lot of people that I talked to, their Dreamcast was stolen because I think it's just such an attractive piece of electronics. You know, it's just sitting there.
Yeah, clearly.
Yeah, nice and portable too, I suppose, under the arm and out the door.
Yeah, unlike the GameCube with the handle on the back. So.
Yeah, or the original Xbox. Oh, that's too heavy. I'll take the Dreamcast.
Yeah, sorry, Scott, carry on.
Well, I know which box my Dreamcasts are in. I've got 3.5, I think. I'd have three main ones. So instead of using the region swap disc, I've got a US Sega Sports Black model and a Japanese NTSC model and my original PAL model that I bought brand new back in the day. So I've got all three of those, and then I bought another two Australian PAL machines to replace the power supply in the US NTSC and the Japanese machines. So they all run on Australian mains.
That's an interesting question. I actually don't know. What is the region code in Australia? Is it PAL?
Yeah, it's PAL. Yeah.
Amazing.
So yeah, we're still connected to the old British system, so we're more or less the same.
Amen.
I think our DVD region code is 4, which is different to probably both of you guys. I don't know.
Yeah, we're region 2. Yeah, it's weird though because I mean, over in the in Australia, you've got a different, completely different like plug that goes into the wall.
Yeah.
But it would still run off the same power supply. It's just completely bizarre.
Yeah, I think the voltage and stuff is still the same, I think. But yeah, we've got this unique looks like a frowny face sort of.
Yeah. So I mean, if you plugged one of those, if you got that plug and plugged it into a UK Dreamcast, it would still work in the But in Australia, and likewise, if you got an Australian Dreamcast and put it into, you know, in the UK and plugged it into the UK power mains, it would still work. So,
yeah. I've got a couple of step down transformers to get the 100 volt and 120 volt power supply for my random non-PAL machines. So I have an Atari Jaguar. So
oh, cool! Oh, excellent!
Yeah, I knew you'd like to be dropping the Jaguar name,
the J bomb.
yeah. Mostly just for Tempest 2000 because I love that game, and that's about all I've ever played on it. So
I was gonna say we'll come back to like the Australian Dreamcast scene very shortly because I think it's something that a lot of people don't know a lot about. But I wanted to ask you firstly about your like collection of like Lindbergh and Naomi machines, because I mean when you got involved with the Junkyard, your first articles were about, you know, Naomi and the possibilities that could have, you know, come from that hardware with the Dreamcast. So I mean, can you explain what you've got?
Well, I can just list what I've got. I've got a Naomi 2, so that was the and the Naomi 2 is compatible with the Naomi 1, so that's but the Naomi 1 was basically the Dreamcast equivalent in the arcade. Yeah. Naomi 2 was the follow up, which had basically just doubled everything, so it was sort of double the RAM and double the I think it's got two tandem power VR GPUs.
Wow!
So there was a handful of Naomi 2 games, including Virtual Fighter 4. And Beach Spikers and Initial D are sort of the main Naomi 2 games, but most of the Naomi games were compatible with the Naomi 1. So I've got most of my games in Naomi 1, which work on the Naomi 2. So this all stemmed from my love of Dreamcast, and I sort of started collecting like the AAA titles and the AA titles and then the A titles, and then started delving into the B titles and the C titles and the D titles that had sort of unique features. And then I sort of started to realize that there wasn't really any more Dreamcast games to get. And I started looking to the arcade games that were based on Dreamcast hardware that weren't converted to Dreamcast, and started to look into how easy it was to have access to those and get a machine running that could play those. And it turned out to be not too bad. The dollars start to add up a bit if you think about much, but I try not to think about it too much.
So I'm a little bit ignorant about this, but the one I think isn't like the Sega driving simulation. Is that one of the ones that was on the Naomi 2?
Yeah, I think so. I don't know whether it was Naomi 2 or Naomi,
but was something that's like a huge cabinet with like, I think it was like three or two like monitors, like with something like that. That won't work with a regular setup, right? You would have to have the...
Yeah, that's right. I started just primarily focusing on the ones that sort of conformed to the JAMA standard of just six buttons on a joystick. So anything more advanced than that was too complicated for me. Anything that required analog controls or multiple screens was just beyond my reach. But there was quite a large catalog of games that conformed to that, just those standard digital inputs. But recently I have picked up a Sega Dreamcast steering wheel that's been converted to run on the JVS analog arcade standard. There was a guy in Japan selling them through Yahoo Auctions Japan, and I picked one up. And I haven't had a chance to like put it through its paces yet, but it connects to the... So I'm planning on doing an article about explaining all of the intricacies on the Junkyard, but there's...
That's actually really interesting, because I'm like... I'm picturing it like, just tell me this one thing. Does it actually come with like the little, does it like hook in like a shelf, or is it just like a separate little unit?
Yeah, so there's, it's just this, all everything I've got is independent of a cabinet, or so I've sort of avoided going the full cabinet. It's full size.
Sure.
It's mostly just connected to via VGA to an LCD monitor, and I've for the digital inputs I converted Dreamcast arcade sticks.
I'm absolutely killing myself for getting rid of my CRT.
Yeah.
Because as far as I know now, like my CRT, like it would have worked with shooting games.
Yeah,
and I got rid of it and I recycled it, and I'm like, now there's none that I can grab.
It's funny you mention that. I mean, I've been after one for so long, and then recently one's come up on a thing called Gumtree that we have in the UK, and I'm going to actually go and pick one up. Oh, really? Yeah, I'm going to go and pick one up on Sunday, proper old school CRT monitor. I'm so excited to get it because I want to see how good the quality is of the VGA connection, you know, on that. It's going to be cool.
I stopped my sister throwing out her old CRT TV, and it's sitting under a shelf at home. I haven't used it in years.
It's I have a small one left.
Yeah, yeah.
I have a small CRT left, but I have a huge one. But the two big ones that I have, they're both flat screen. So I don't believe my light gun games will work on the flat screen CRTs, or if they won't. So boy, that's just disappointing.
Scott, going back to your collection, I know you've got some like Lindbergh machines as well. Can you talk a little bit about those?
I don't want to give away my secrets because everyone will start doing it. But I was going to mention it to Caleb when he was looking for alternative places to find Dreamcast games and stuff. Yeah. I've been getting a lot of stuff via proxy services for Yahoo Auctions Japan. So the one I tend to use is buye.jp, so buye.jp. I sort of look a fair bit on there and pick up some stuff. And then if you order quite a lot of things, because you have to pay for domestic shipping within Japan to the warehouse and then shipping from the warehouse to wherever you live. But if you get a number of things from Japan and get them all collected at the warehouse, and it's just one shipping fee from the warehouse to your house, which is what I've been doing a fair bit sort of relatively recently. I'm trying to save my pennies now instead of wasting it on ancient Sega arcade hardware. But yeah, there's if you go to eBay and look for a Sega Lindbergh, just via regular eBay, you're looking at about $700-$800 for just the unit without a power supply or the input output board or the connections to the input. If you go to Yahoo Auctions Japan, you might get some for 10,000 yen, which works at about $100, I think, if I'm doing my maths right. So they're quite cheap, they seem to have quite a surplus number of them. I started with the Lindbergh Yellow, which is the universal unit that plays all games. And then I started noticing that the red units and the blue units and the grey and the silver units were also coming up quite cheap. And I didn't really need all of these different units, but it's so poorly documented in the West that no one really knows the exact difference between all of them. So I thought, well, I'll just buy them and open them up and have a look what components are inside and see how they differ. And I'm sort of researching that and compiling some comparisons between them to publish on.
If you or / we don't do this, who else will? You know, I mean, we are nerds, but we're giving the world, you know, what is not being given by the so-called professionals. Do you know what I mean? So, I mean, we are providing service. Right. I mean, certainly with what you've done with the Naomi stuff that you've put on the junkyard, it's been phenomenal. You know, the feedback has been great because there's nowhere else you can find this information.
Well, there used to be a website, Sega-Naomi.com, where I learned a lot of the information that I needed to buy all the separate components and put them together and get them to work. But it seems to be a bit dormant at the moment. There used to be a forum attached to it where you could go in and ask people questions about how to put things together. And I'm sure there's other arcade forums out there as well. But yeah, just sort of got to go digging a bit. I think that the typical recommendation is to track down a there was a Capcom, because you buy the base unit, but you still need a separate power supply. And there's a separate input-output board that sort of filters the inputs before it reaches the base unit. And the recommendations I was reading at the time were to track down the Capcom input-output unit because it was most similar to the Jamma standard that most earlier 90s arcade machines were using. So people that had the old school super guns that plugged into the arcade boards to run their games were compatible with this Capcom input-output unit. But I came into it blank slate and I didn't have any super guns or anything. So I actually opted for the cheaper Sega input-output unit and managed to get it working fine. I actually, when I pulled apart the Dreamcast arcade stick and started recycling some of the components of that. So there's a cable in that, which actually has six pins, which connects to the five pin power input of the input output board. So I just jammed it onto there and used the five wires coming out of that to power the input output board. And it worked fine. So it was that was pretty good. Because it's often hard to track down some of these.
Clearly a font of knowledge, you know, when it comes to arcade hardware. But I wanted to pick your brains about a different subject slightly. I wanted to ask you about the Australian Dreamcast like launch and scene, because it's not something that a lot of people outside of Australia have ever like maybe thought about, but I've heard, or rather I've read, that it was a bit of a disaster.
Yeah.
Well, of course it was. I mean, everybody left their house, and immediately they were attacked by the most poisonous creatures on Earth. And they said, what are we doing? We're in Australia. Everything will kill us. Let's go back into our house. And, you know, nobody went to the... that's how it worked. You know, I'm right, right?
Can you confirm or deny this, Scott?
Yeah. Have you read one of Terry Pratchett's novels about... he did an alternative version of Australia. Yes. for Discworld, and Death asks, you know, about the poisonous and deadly creatures in Australia, and he gets inundated with volumes like volume 307, part 2, paragraph 3 or something. And then they make a suggestion, his servant makes a suggestion, maybe he should ask about some of the non-deadly animals in Australia, and a single sheet of paper floats down from above that says, some of the sheep are the only non-dangerous animals in Australia. I grew up in country New South Wales, so there was never going to be any giant launch parties or people lining up the streets to get their Dreamcast. So, because I wasn't in any of the urban centres, it sort of passed me by. I didn't really know much about how good or bad the launch went. So I didn't read about it till later, like, and probably from similar sources that Tom read. But I'll just start with the personal experience first. And I don't even remember, because we didn't even have a dedicated like video game store in the town that I grew up in. But I could get stuff from department stores and appliance, like electronics, TV appliance stores. And I used to order special things from a mail order service in Sydney. But I don't even remember when the Dreamcast first appeared, but you know, it must have appeared in the department store at some time, and I was playing on those Dreamcast kiosks and sort of was aware of it at the time. And I was reading maybe a couple of a dedicated Australian video game magazines, but I wasn't reading them at the time. I was reading UK magazines, so I was getting sort of the UK experience and the stuff that I was reading. And looking at in the lead up to the Dreamcast, looking at the different tech demos that they did with the director's face that was ripping off Mario intro, and the Tower of Babel with the water and stuff, and reading about the Shenmue's development, and looking, do you remember there was like screenshots of all the different antennas, TV antennas that they were designing for each individual house had a different TV antenna.
You were getting all this from like UK magazines then?
Yeah, I was reading UK magazines that took, they were always like 2 months out of date because they were shipped like via sea freight. So that was like a 2 month delay, but that's what I was getting my information from.
Thinking back now to like the time when you think about it, it was like the sort of the late 90s. So like the internet wasn't like a major thing like it is now. So you couldn't just literally log onto a game site and go, oh, this is what's happening in the gaming world. It was all coming through magazines.
So I was reading about it, and I was pretty convinced that Dreamcast was the system to go for. I remember there was a particular review in Computer and Video Games magazine from the UK that was making a comparison between the launch Tekken title for PS2, was Tekken Tag Tournament or something, and comparing it against Dead or Alive 2 on the Dreamcast. And the outcome was basically Dead or Alive 2 came out on top between those two games, but Soul Calibur crushed both of them. So the recommendation was pretty much forget about PlayStation 2 and forget about the emotion engine rubbish, because the games actually looked better on Dreamcast and were actually more fun to play. So
yes!
I was entirely convinced to get a Dreamcast. at the time I was finishing high school and finishing my final exams and coming of age, like turning 18, and I did pretty well in my final exams. And as a reward, you would typically expect to get your first car, but I actually got a Dreamcast as a reward for completing high school.
Wow.
And to this day, I have an extensive Dreamcast collection, but I still don't know how to drive. I'm still quite happy with my decision, but I'm not sure whether others would understand, but that's quite all right. When I went in to buy my Dreamcast from the department store in December, it would have been December 2000.
Wait, we can do a quick skit here. You come in and ask for your Dreamcast.
Well, I picked up the bright blue box off the shelf and walked to the counter and said, "I'd like to buy this, please."
What's it in?
Hey, I'd like to buy this Dreamcast, please.
What's it?
It's this system that's competing against the PlayStation 2.
I'm sorry, I don't know about that. We got a wallaby in the bag. You want it?
Yeah.
Okay, that's terrible.
It's really bad.
That is terrible.
In my head, I was like, I nailed it. I got it really good. And it's, I'm so sorry. Please continue your story.
No, I was quite impressed. I wasn't too bad. Well, you're not far from the truth, because when I went to the counter with my Dreamcast and my copy of Soul Calibur and Sonic Adventure, the guy behind the counter basically said, "Nah, you don't want to buy that." And I said, "Why not?" He said, "Yeah, no, I wouldn't recommend buying a Dreamcast at this stage." And I said, "Oh, I'm convinced. I want a Dreamcast." I'm going to buy it. "Oh, okay, but don't say I didn't warn you." And then 6 weeks later, I'm watching the news on TV and Sega has discontinued production of the Dreamcast and it's all over. But I didn't regret my decision, because I was playing through Soul Calibur and Sonic Adventure and having a good time, and I knew from the UK magazines that there was still stuff on the way. But it didn't actually click until Caleb said in a DreamPod issue a few issues back about the slip up that someone said back in August 2000 about Sega had stopped producing Dreamcasts. And the press sort of ran with it and said it was all over and finished, but it was more just stating that they had a backlog and they were just sort of easing off.
That's remarkably similar to like my situation when I bought it, because I bought it right at the end of its cycle too. I actually got mine from a friend who bought like an Xbox, and he didn't need his Dreamcast anymore, so I bought it off him. And it didn't really hit until I just couldn't find games in stores anymore, and that was years later.
Yeah. No, I mean, I mean, I had mine from the beginning. Not like trying to blow me on trumpet, but I mean, it was quite a short lifespan. You know,
everybody was in a situation where they graduated from high school and their parents just gave them one. Some of us had to wait until college when we were grown ass adults and bought one for themselves.
Hey. I sold my N64 and got one.
So you're just saying you're a bigger Sega fan. I understand. I understand what's going on.
But yeah, it's interesting to hear the Australian side of things, because one other thing I want to ask you about: what were the adverts like? Did you have the TV adverts? Did you have the barber?
No, I don't think we got anything. Like, I don't know whether it was just because I was on regional TV and they weren't paying for spots on regional TV, but I wasn't aware of any marketing or advertising for the Dreamcast at all. Reading about it later, it seems like there was a complete stuff up and they paid some advertising company to do something, but nothing actually ever happened. And then later on in 2001, I think they relaunched it as a cheap alternative to getting on the internet. And there was supposedly advertising around that as well, but I never saw anything. Except for maybe that one you posted on the Facebook page from Harvey Norman.
Yeah, that was the one that was the was it the House of the Dead 2, which was like a woman like in all red.
Showing
bars or something.
Yeah, that wasn't the one I was referring to, because I never saw that one, but I wasn't in bars at the time. So and that particular one is quite interesting, because it seemed to be aimed towards the female gamer, and I assume it was in or near the female toilets, but this is where Caleb jumped in and wondering what the hell we were talking about prior to when we started recording. I don't know much about where that came from or how successful that was, but it was an interesting take on it. Yeah. But the one I was referring to was the TV commercial from Harvey Norman, which is a sort of a furniture and appliance superstore in Australia. And it was that sort of typical shouty ad where it's like, you know, buy now, buy the Sega Dreamcast, buy it now, you know, and free Slave Zero with your Sega Dreamcast. And
that's the one I posted a few weeks ago.
That's If there was any exposure to advertising, that might have been it, but it was imminently forgettable. It wasn't particularly impressive or creative. So, I was thinking back. I was trying to remember. I was sort of getting into the context leading up to the release of Dreamcast, because Sydney had Sega World for a number of years. There was like a theme park Sega World on Darling Harbour, and I was trying to remember because I visited it back in it must have been 97, 98, and it was a lot of fun. And they had, as you left, there was a store with Sega Saturns piled up to the ceiling that nobody seemed to be particularly interested in, but there was a lot of them to choose from. And I was wondering whether Sega World was still around when the Dreamcast was out, and whether that store would have had piles and piles of Dreamcasts to buy. But I'm not sure. I know it didn't stay open for a long time. I'm trying to remember whether it was still open when the Dreamcast was available. I think it might have been.
We had one in London.
Yeah,
and it was quite popular when the Saturn was around.
Yeah,
but by the time the Dreamcast rolled around, it was gone.
Didn't Gaga Man do a bunch of articles or something? Where didn't somebody do an article where somebody went to one like a couple of years back or something? Am I just making that up in my brain? The one that was still going, but like, you know, basically there wasn't a lot there anymore. It was basically just kind of like a half-empty arcade.
Where I live now in Southampton, there used to be one which was called Sega World, but it wasn't like a proper like official thing. It was just an arcade which had a couple of Sega arcade machines in it, but it was mainly them like ice hockey things that you're gonna like smash a puck around on, like air hockey. But yeah, it wasn't like an official thing. I do remember that, but apart from that, I can't really think of anything. Anyway, moving on swiftly from that car crash.
I was gonna mention it was similar to Caleb's experience where he couldn't find any games. I struggled to find games in Australia too. And it wasn't until I read about it years later that Sega AussieSoft made a huge mistake with retailers in that they sold them Dreamcast stock. I can't remember the dollar amounts, but they sold it like wholesale for $375 or something. And then when the PlayStation 2 came out, or in the lead up to the PlayStation 2, they cut the recommended retail price down to like below 350. So retailers that still had Dreamcasts in stock were sort of forced to sell them below what they paid for them.
Wow.
And most of the retailers sort of got their backs up at that and said, well, we're no longer going to supply and stock Dreamcast titles because you're not treating us right. And then so when I'm looking for games, I only ever really saw sort of the first wave or the first and second wave of games, and any titles sort of beyond that never really materialized in Australia, which was quite bizarre, because like at the time I just started ordering stuff off eBay and just got on with it. But looking back, I was like, yeah, that's why it was so hard, because only really, really dedicated specific game stores were actually stocking it, and all the major retailers were sort of shunning it. So it just had no chance after that. But I did remember, it would have been late 2001 or early 2002, a game store I went into did have copies of Shenmue 2, and I think it was Phantasy Star Online version 2, or it might have been Headhunter, or it might have been Rez, but I remember there were two sort of very late Dreamcast PAL releases that were actually on store shelves in Australia. So I thought it was quite impressive that they persevered to continue bringing those to Australia. But yeah, it was a bit of a dog's break.
There's some late releases on the shelves, yeah.
Actually,
you mentioned Headhunter. I think we're going to move on now to the next subject,
yep.
Which is something that you mentioned that you wanted to speak about. And I have actually looked into this quite extensively because of what you said to me. And that is that Headhunter was going to utilize the VMU in ways that have not actually come to fruition in any game. before or after it was actually announced. And I think it's such an interesting use of the VMU.
Yeah, yeah.
Please go ahead, explain to the listeners what we're talking about.
Yeah, I was trying to find more information about it, and I've struggled to find it. So I don't know whether it's just something that I've made up in my head and thought was true that I read in a magazine back in the day, or
not at all.
The VMU was planned to be used in Headhunter as a pager. Mm-hmm. So my understanding of it was that you would play Headhunter, say Tuesday night, and you'd get to a certain point, and perhaps you were on the case looking for a particular bounty, and you'd turn the Dreamcast off, and you'd pull the VMU out, and you'd put it in your pocket, and then the next day you'd go to work or school or whatever, and you'd check your VMU screen, and there'd be like a message from the game world, like telling you that the guy you were looking for would be, you know, at a certain location in the game, like at 7 o'clock that night or something. Mm-hmm. And I don't know whether there would be a button to confirm that you read that information and you were going to return to the game at 7 o'clock that night, or whether you could like abort and. So there was sort of a continuous sort of stream between the game world sort of running in real time and you and your real life running in real time, and the VMU sort of synchronized with the game world and the Dreamcast. And then you would either rush home that afternoon and turn the game on and get to the location to meet or capture that guy, or you might be stuck, you know, at your girlfriend's place or at a family dinner or something, and you'd miss that meeting in the game.
You'd miss the guy,
You'd return to the game the next day, and it's like you missed that opportunity, and the game would continue off in a different story tree and things like that. And I thought that was a brilliant idea.
Brilliant way of utilizing the VMU. And such an original way of doing things. You know, I have to admit, I also read about this after you had actually told me about it.
Yeah, yeah.
And I went looking for it, and I found out, you know, all these articles that said that this feature was coming in the game. And I just thought to myself, how amazing would that have been, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
To get, like, you know, faux, like, messages, like text messages or beeper messages, like, throughout the day, where you're like...
Yeah.
That said, the VMU battery is horrendous. Do you know what I mean? So
how
good could that... I mean, maybe they looked at that and thought, well, this isn't going to work because no one's going to have a VMU in the pocket with a battery that's lasting longer than you know, a couple of hours.
Yeah, I can... So. I can say, and then, like, for technical feasibility sort of point of view, you could imagine that the messages would only last for potentially, you know, a day or half a day. Like, you can't imagine that if you turned the game off for like 2 weeks and went on holiday, that the VMU would continue to give you live updates of, even if the battery lasted that long, whether it would continue to give live updates of what was happening in the game world over such an extended period. Yeah.
And even to the point where, I mean, we're talking about 2000, 2001 here, so the messages would have had to have been loaded onto the VMU
at the time
you were playing for, you know, you to then go back. I mean, it wasn't Wi-Fi enabled. It wasn't Bluetooth enabled.
No.
I mean, it was very ambitious.
You can see, like, within certain constraints that it would have been feasible, but to have sort of those events sort of pre-planned before it was loaded into the VMU. But it didn't make the cut. Obviously, they had technical difficulties trying to make it work, but it would have been a really interesting idea. And like even today, I don't think it's a very well-utilized idea. I haven't really kept up to date with the next generation of video gaming or the current generation.
I think the only thing I can think of that even comes close to that is something that still hasn't come out, which would be the Drive Club companion app, which was lauded, you know, as like a thing where you could kind of keep up to date with your team on Drive Club on the PS4.
Oh, okay.
Via an app on your like iPhone or your Android phone. And even that hasn't actually come out yet. So, I mean, this, going back to 2001, is so far, like, you know, above the pale. It's ridiculous.
It'd be nice to see it more in story-driven games and having that component sort of driving which direction the story went in as well. I thought of a comparison back in the 80s microcomputer days in the UK. There was some Cold War diplomacy game on one of, I don't know whether it was the Spectrum or the Commodore 64 or something. And at a certain point in the game, if negotiations went south between you and Russia or something, you could get up and walk away from your computer and go to the telephone and ring a 1-800 number, and it would give you a code to input into your computer to launch the nuclear strike against the Soviets.
Oh my God, that sounds brilliant.
And I don't know whether it was just the same code repeated over and over again over the phone, or whether it was like a primitive form of what do they call it, two-stage authentication, whether code would change in time with the code in the game. And like between there's that example and Headhunter, and apart from that, I can't think of anything else.
If you and a friend had a key that you had to turn at the same time, and you're like, on my mark.
And I forget the name, but I know there was a PC game that would like literally like call you in the middle of the night with information and stuff like that. It's really, really out there. I forget the name of it. I could find out, but I'm not going to bother. Anyways, there's lots of interesting little like, you know, ARG like, you know, type stuff that's going on now. And it'll be interesting to see how that fits in with like the new wave of like, you know, technology that basically everybody has
with
now.
With the VMU, I mean, they had a lot of plans for it. And if the Dreamcast had lived on longer than the 2 years that it actually had, I mean, who knows where it could have gone? We had the MP3 player was planned for it.
Yeah.
We had the Sega Swatch we've briefly mentioned on the podcast before. There were so many different things planned for this piece of little tiny piece of technology that, you know, could have completely transformed gaming as we know it. You know, a little piece of the game that you can take away with you in your pocket and then come back to it and then.
But the Dreamcast 2 is exposing one of the big things, like the whole planned obsolescence thing. Like Tom has that karaoke unit, which is basically just a piece of plastic because they never planned on supporting it past its original thing. So nobody does planned obsolescence anymore. So all this cool stuff, they really just need to kind of take notes from what worked and what did not work from the Dreamcast era and just consider, I mean, what's going to happen to all this stuff in the future. You know, you just kind of should be looking back to what the mistakes and the successes that Sega did.
Yeah, that's something I've been concerned about too, because from a young age I learned in video gaming, if you wait long enough, just about everything becomes $20. So instead of going out for your launch machine at, you know, $700-$800, if you're prepared to wait, you know, a decade or a decade and a half, you'll probably pick it up for $20 at a secondhand store eventually.
That said, I mean, I think there's kind of like a weird. It's not. This is going to sound like completely the wrong context to use this term, but it's like an uncanny valley where you kind of get that sort of period between when it's actually worth something and then it's not worth anything.
It's
like worth something again.
Yeah, that's,
you know what I mean? it's like a valley of depth of worth.
Yeah, that's sort of only just started to come in. In the early days, that was never my experience. Things always sort of just got more and more worthless and never sort of started to rise again, but it has been an issue lately. But
honestly, the Dreamcast is like the last system where the vast majority of the games are still like, well, this all works. Even on the Xbox, there's a lot of games out there where there's content that you can no longer get, period, because the servers that provided it are no longer there. And it's very interesting. It's the Dreamcast is like the last one where it's like the vast majority of the stuff you can still use.
Yeah, that's my big worry moving forward as well, because with this attitude I have of staying like one or two generations behind to get stuff cheaper later, it doesn't really apply anymore with the PS4 and Xbox One world, because if I buy one, you know, 10 years from now, the vast majority of the content isn't going to work for me anymore. Which is a bit of a shame.
My dad lives in a house without Wi-Fi, which is unheard of in this day and age. But he says to me, "Oh, I'm going to get a PS4," and I was like, "Dad, there's no point because you've not got any internet." You buying a PS4 now is like me buying a PS4 in 15 years' time. It won't work. It won't do anything.
Yeah.
You know, you can play the games very basically, but you can't get the full experience. And that is where we're at. With the Dreamcast, it was like you said, Caleb, it was a last console where it didn't matter if you had an internet connection or not. It was like a nice added extra, and pretty much everything worked. I mean, I know there's a couple of games that do not work anymore, like Planet Ring, but the vast majority of them will function without an internet connection. Whereas now, I mean, can you imagine playing Titanfall in 10 years? It won't work. You know what I mean?
Unless...
It all depends.
Yeah, there'll be dedicated hackers possibly that'll try and set up, you know, alternative servers eventually, but it depends whether there's any demand for it or not, I suppose. We'll all move on to the next biggest and better thing, I suppose.
I think we'll move on to the next section now, and that is, it's probably going to be me mainly talking now, so I apologise for that. But I recently delved into the murky world of emulation on the Apple Mac. Do either of you two use an Apple Mac?
No.
I used to use one a lot for, I used to use it for editing, but that was years ago.
Yeah, I mean, like I said, I use it basically for, like, image manipulation and sound editing, but that's pretty much my only machine, a Mac. And recently I had to get a lot of, like, high-res images of Dreamcast games, and I was advised to get them via emulation. And I knew that there was, like, things like Rycast on the Android platform, and things like Null DC on Windows. But I'd never really looked at what was available for the Mac. And, you know, I'm guessing there might be a lot of people listening to this who actually own a Mac but didn't realise that there is a method of emulating the Dreamcast on the machine. And the best thing I found was a thing called LX Dream. Have you guys heard of that at all?
Nope.
No, I'm quite interested in the discussion, though. I've been meaning to look into Dreamcast emulation for, like, any platform, but I haven't looked into it at this stage, so yeah.
Yeah, I mean, if you've got, like, a pretty good PC, you can use Null DC, which will emulate the Dreamcast pretty much, as far as I can see, 100%. On the Mac, you're limited to pretty much this one, and I think there might be another one as well, but I'm not that well-versed in what the other alternatives are, so I used LX Dream.
And how bad was it?
it pretty much ran everything I threw at it. But
that's a start.
Yes, some games ran at, like, maybe 1 or 2 frames a second. Some ran at maybe 15. I think the only game that ran at a decent playable speed was Outrigger.
All right.
Which ran playable enough. Yeah, but in some stages it would keep popping up with this, like, dialogue box on the screen, where it would say that a frame buffer had failed or something.
Yeah.
You had to keep pressing, like, return over and over again. So I think what I'm trying to say is, if you want to emulate the Dreamcast, don't do it on a Mac. It's a painful experience. But yeah, there's not a lot of information online or anywhere about trying to emulate the Dreamcast on the Mac, so I just wanted to tell people that it can be done, but with a lot of effort and patience. Patience is the key.
I guess for taking screenshots, it doesn't really matter what the frame rate's like, but if that's not primary goal, you're going to run into trouble.
That's true, yeah. I mean, my main goal was to take screenshots, but to try to get to a point in the game to actually take the screenshots was a bit of a pain in the ass. My MacBook is a mid-2012 one, so it's not particularly old, and it's got quite a bit of power. But still, it was struggling with LX Dream. So if anyone's listening to this who's interested in developing a Mac Dreamcast emulator, then please continue with your work.
Is there a like a virtual machine type setup where you could run like the Windows or the Android version of the emulator via a virtual machine within the Mac? I don't know whether that would make things 10 times worse or better, I'm not sure.
I was basically told to try using, is it Boot Camp, where you can, like, boot the Mac into Windows run, like, Null DC through that.
Yeah. But
to be honest, like I say, I'm using a MacBook, and I don't think it would have the grunt to, like, run a non-native operating system and then a Dreamcast on top of that.
Yeah, yeah.
It would probably be just as efficient to run LX Dream at 20 frames a second.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
One thing I've been meaning to look into, sort of as an offshoot of this, is with my number of spare Lindberghs. So the Sega Lindbergh is essentially just a Pentium 4 PC with a NVIDIA 7800, like a special Sega brand NVIDIA 7800 GPU. Okay. And I'm planning on selling 4 out of the 5 that I own, because I don't really need 5. And I was thinking about
need 5 Lindberghs.
I was thinking about whether I've been meaning to test it out, whether it was possible to get to override like the firmware and the software to run Windows and then run a Dreamcast emulator on the Lindbergh. Wow. And then like swap out the hard drive so you could have a Lindbergh mode and a Dreamcast mode all on the one system. And I've been meaning to test it out, but I haven't got around to it yet. And I was looking at the Steam OS, and there's a ICE emulator or something that runs the stuff I've been reading. It runs Mega Drive and SNES and things and PlayStation and things. And it talks about GameCube and Wii and Nintendo 64, but there doesn't seem to be a lot of info confirming that the Dreamcast also works in it.
So wait a minute, you'd like to run Windows or Steam on a Lindbergh to emulate a Dreamcast?
Yeah, yeah.
That is hardcore.
Yeah, I was gonna like sell it and brand it as a Dreamcast 3, so you could have a. A Dreamcast mode, and I think the Dreamcast emulators run Naomi and Atomos Wave as well now. So you could have your Dreamcast and your Naomi and your Atomos Wave and your Lindbergh games all from the one unit underneath your TV. And I thought, I wonder whether someone will pay big money for that or not.
That is an all-in-one box. I would love to see.
Yeah. I'm planning on building one for myself, and then if it works, I'll build a few more and see if anybody's interested in buying one. But
well, I'm sure they will be. Yeah. Anyway, guys, we've like waffled on for over an hour now, so I think almost an hour. So I think we'll draw a line under it there.
I had so many other things to say as well. I'll have to come back another time.
Yeah, please save them for the next time.
Yeah, yeah.
We'll get you on again, obviously. I just wanted to say thank you to you, Scott, for taking the time to come on the Dream Pod for the first time.
Well, you did make it easy for me. You did make it easy for me by getting up after midnight at your end, and it's bright and early at this end. So.
Yeah, yeah. What time is it there?
It's 10:15. In the morning.
Excellent. It's 1:15 in the morning here now. Caleb, while we're enjoying what time it is, what time is it where you are?
It's time to end the podcast.
Amen. That was my American impression, by the way, in case you didn't realize.
Didn't kick off on it? No, sorry.
we'll draw a line there. And like I said, thank you very much for listening to everyone who is listening. Scott, are you on? You're on Twitter now, aren't you?
I am. Yeah. As part of joining the yard, I sort of joined Twitter for the first time. But most of my tweets have been about the Sega SC3000 computer from the 80s. So not a lot of Dreamcast stuff on there at the moment.
Everybody loves a bit of retro Sega. It doesn't really matter. So what's your Twitter account?
So it's doc_eggfan, all lowercase. I think you had trouble finding it before because there must be a Sonic Eggman Twitter account that is
similar name. Actually thinks he is actually Dr. Robotnik using that name as well, and I think he takes it a bit too far. So it's not Robotnik or Eggfan, it's doc_eggfan.
Yeah.
Caleb, you're on Twitter as well.
Yes, I am. And amazingly enough, somebody found me. They must have followed me from one of the tweets that I made when I originally did the promotion for the fifth Dreamcast podcast. And somehow they found me and they messaged me. And apparently they're taking me up on my offer for anybody to try to get all the ones correct from our competition that we're having, which is still going on now. And boy, that was one person who tracked me. And I'm to say, yes, they're going to take up this challenge and they're going to try to guess all the pictures. So that's very amazing.
What Caleb's talking about there is the 10th anniversary part 2 competition that we're running at the moment. We've got a load of pictures of Dreamcast games on the site. All you've got to do is guess them all correctly and then send your entry to admin@thedreamcastjunkyard.co.uk. That's the website. The dreamcastjunkyard.co.uk is the URL. We're also on Facebook, which is facebook.com/thedreamcastjunkyard. And I'm Tom. I'm on Twitter at TomLeeC. And please feel free to follow us, comment, give us a 5-star review on iTunes. We love that. Also, one other thing is that people on the American iTunes have also started giving us reviews. So we thank you for that. And
Awesome.
We do read the reviews and also take into consideration what you say. So we're going to start making the intro a little bit shorter and not talk about what we've been playing so much.
Next time.
From the next episode onwards. Yes.
Just quickly before we go, I'm looking at the Shenmue 3 Kickstarter, and it's just shy of 6.2 million with 94 minutes to go and just shy of 68,000 backers. So by the time you listen to this, it'll be all over, but it's doing quite well at this moment.
Yeah, so if you've not backed it...
It's too late now.
You can't back it now because you're not... It's gone, it's finished. But if you have, fantastic, you're a legend. Anyway, that's pretty much all we've got time for this time. Thanks very much for listening. You've been listening to myself, Tom. You've been listening to Scott and Caleb. Guys, anything else you want to say? Or
nope, there's nothing I say.
No, I got something I need to say. I need to do something I need to get off my chest. You know, I'm just over here at Caleb's house. I'm listening to the podcast being rewarded. And he's just, why are you so mean to Caleb? What did he do? Why is this conspiracy from the UK?
Jesse, it's fine. Tom doesn't mean it. It's fine. It's okay. Sit back down.
Give him a Dreamcast controller.
I can't. Jesse, no. Sit back down. I'm sorry. He came over. We're going to go lift weights after this, so I'm sorry.
Jesse Ventura is about to rip Caleb's head off, so we're going to go. So, yeah, thanks for listening. Bye.
Goodbye.
Bye.